When we spoke as a planning committee about what we wanted to do this year, we wanted to focus on Jesus and how that informs our work as scientists. And so, fitting with this theme of theological foundations for Christians in science, we hope to raise our understanding of theology to help us as both Christians and scientists. And we're not trying to just harmonize Christian faith and science, but learn how a theological perspective can help inform and transform our scientific understanding. I think tonight's speaker is very well qualified to help us do that, particularly in the area of theological anthropology. And if you're not familiar with that area, I mean, this is not physical anthropology that deals with fossils and skeletons and all. This is not cultural anthropology that deals with customs and ways of people living. I'm gonna let Dr. Cortez unpack that for what it is, but I can say he will help us focus on Christ and help us better understand what it means to be truly human, made in the image of God. Now, to introduce our speaker, Dr. Mark Cortez, serves as Associate Professor of Theology at Wheaton. He and his family came to Wheaton in 2013 after teaching for 7 years at Western Seminary in Portland. He served as a youth pastor before this, and he has written several books, which is, well, I'm particularly excited about the content he'll be bringing us tonight from that depth of consideration and putting this together. A couple of books I was, one I looked at in our library, Theological Anthropology, A Guide for the Perplexed, and I understand a forthcoming book on Christological Anthropology and Historical Perspective. I'm looking tonight to looking forward to gaining a deeper understanding of the topic, embodied souls, Christology, theology, and mind-body relationship. And hope you'll join me in welcoming Dr. Mark Cortez.
All right, well, thank you. I appreciate the great comments about the different ways in which theological anthropology can be understood. I always find it interesting when I introduce myself to people and I say that I study theological anthropology. I'm intrigued by the fact that everyone skips the theological bit in that phrase, because nobody really knows entirely what that means. They latch on to the anthropology part because they have some concept of what anthropology is. And then I find myself fielding really interesting questions about whether or not I enjoy studying indigenous cultures in the Amazonian rainforest in Brazil, or if I like going on archaeological digs or whatnot. And then I get to explain that's not really the kind of anthropology that I do. And we have to back up a second and talk about why the word theological is in front of the word anthropology when I'm talking about my particular field of study. And it's because what I'm interested in are specifically theological perspectives on what it means to be human. And of course, lots of different disciplines have perspectives on what it means to be human. I can't think actually of any particular discipline in the humanities or the sciences or the social sciences that don't have something to say about what it means to be human. And it makes theological anthropology a bit of a challenging discipline to be involved in. You know, almost everybody has something to say about what it is that you're studying. And generally speaking, that means that almost everybody thinks you're wrong about some perspective that you're bringing to the table, right? So you're navigating all of these different voices, all of these different perspectives on precisely what it means to be human. Right? When I went through my doctoral work at the University of St. Andrews, I had the joy of sitting in my external examination with Dr. John Webster, who's a renowned theologian in the UK and has a very theological understanding of how we should go about looking at things like the human person. And then the other side of the table was somebody like Dr. Malcolm Jeeves, who is a cognitive neuroscientist from the University of St. Andrews, who has a slightly different perspective on how we should go about understanding the human person. And I'm at the end of the table, precisely between these two individuals, trying to figure out how to field questions from both of them in a way that will not alienate the other one. So the unique task of theological anthropology is to bring a theological voice into the discussion about what it means to be human in a way that navigates the difference or the differences that we find between these different disciplines. And of course, those differences are there because everybody has been asking for, I don't know how many years, what in the world does it mean to be human? Right? Every religion, every philosophical system, every worldview, every scientific discipline has contributed something to the question of what does it mean to be human? And the biblical authors are no exception to this. Right? The biblical authors routinely raise in the text themselves the question of what does it mean to be human? Right? They want to contribute to this ongoing conversation that we have about understanding the human person, understanding anthropology. But the unique perspective that the biblical authors bring when they raise the question of what does it mean to be human, it's interesting, in the five or six times throughout the biblical text that a biblical author asks, what is the human person? They never ask the question by itself. If you actually look at how the questions get unfolded, it's not just what is mankind, it's what is mankind that you are mindful of them. It's not just what are human beings, but what are human beings that you care for them. Right? Consistently throughout the biblical text, the anthropological question of what does it mean to be human is an inherently theological question. They immediately frame the question in the context of the human person and the human person's relationship to the Creator. And presume that really you can only understand what it means to be human in the context of that theological framework. Okay, that's their starting point. That's the initial assumption that they make when they talk about what it means to be human. Well, that immediately raises what I think are some really important questions. If we're going to assume that you can only answer the anthropological question inside of a theological framework, there's some fundamental questions that I think we should all be asking ourselves. The first one, which I don't know, just skip right out quickly, is what is the theological starting point? What are we talking about when we say that we can only understand the human person inside a theological framework, from a theological starting point? What in the world do we mean by that? What is this theological framework? Second question is, what does this mean for interdisciplinary dialogue? And when I hang out with a friend who's a cognitive neuropsychologist, and I tell that person that I think you can only understand the human person adequately from a theological starting point, and this person has a huge data set that comes from a completely different framework and starting point, what are the implications for how I can talk to that person, how we can have meaningful conversation about the human person? When it sort of sounds like I've had closed dialogue from the very beginning by telling them they started in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. And then the third question is, what does this look like in practice? It's one thing to talk rather abstractly about principles of starting from a theological perspective and making sure that we're being nice to other people who want to talk about the human person. But when we get down kind of the nitty gritty, we look at specific issues about the human person. What exactly does that look like? I'm going to try to walk you through all three of those questions this evening. There's a fair chance that I will speed up as we go. I'm going to try to say a little bit about what kind of theological framework provides an adequate ground for understanding the human person. That's something we could spend really the whole semester on, it, let alone the whole evening. But I'll kind of gesture at what kind of theological framework that looks like. Then make some comments about what the implications are for interdisciplinary dialogue, given that theological starting point. And then the third step will be really what will get us into the mind-body conversation, right? That will be really our case study for how do we tease this out in a very specific situation. The mind-body issues, how we understand the relationship between mind and body, body and soul, those are live topics today. So that will be our specific practical case study. What does this look like when we apply it a particular issue? So, we start with number one. What is our theological starting point? Long-standing tradition in Christian theology that the fundamental, non-negotiable starting point for understanding the human person is the person of Jesus Christ. This is something from the earliest parts of Christian history. You can go back to thinkers like Irenaeus. In just the first few centuries, you can look at quotations from Origen or Athanasius. Our fundamental theologians in Christian history all started from the premise that we don't really know what it means to be human until we have looked at who Jesus is. We can gain some insights, maybe, about what it means to be human, but we don't put them into the proper context until we have the perspective, the broader framework, offered through the Incarnation. Karl Barth, a more recent theologian, kind of unpacks in a rather lengthy quotation I want to break down a little bit for us some of the theological intuitions behind this understanding that we have to start with the person of Jesus Christ. What he says is the ontological determination of humanity is grounded in Jesus. Right, that's perfectly self-evident what he means by that, right? We're really clear by that. Yeah, we can just go to the next slide. Right, so to unpack that, by ontological determination, all he means is what it fundamentally is to be human. Right, in our being, the determination of what it means to be human, that ontological determination is grounded in Jesus. Right, so he's reiterating in kind of more modern and therefore somewhat more obscure language that what it means to be human is ultimately grounded in Jesus. Therefore, we are condemned to abstraction so long as our attention is riveted on man in general. Right? So as long as we remove our attention from Jesus, the particular incarnate Christ, and kind of look at humanity in general, we're condemned to abstraction. Right? Because we've removed ourselves in his framework from the one thing that reveals what it means to be human. And as soon as we move outside of that, we're kind of guessing. Right? We're putting general abstract theories together. And he doesn't actually have a problem with that. He just wants us to know that we've moved into this realm of kind of theoretical abstraction because we've left the one Archimedean point given us beyond humanity. The one objective reference that we have for what it means to be human in Jesus Christ. As soon as we neglect that and move on to kind of general studies about humanity, there's nothing wrong with that, but let's just recognize that we're operating in a different realm. We're operating in a realm of this non-Christological, non-theological of our things that is more abstract, more speculative, more theoretical. Theological anthropology, then, is not yet or no longer theological anthropology. It tries to pose and answer the question of the true being of man from any other angle. Which, if we are truly to be theological in our understanding of the human person, Christology is the only possible starting point. Right, where I find the quote helpful is because it unpacks kind of that theological intuition that has been with the church from the very beginning. That Christology, the incarnate God-man, is a fundamental starting point for what it means to be human. Now, why? The church wrestled with that question as well. And why exactly is it so important for us to start with Christology for understanding the human person? Well, the first point was that we have to affirm in the Incarnation, and we can spend, of course, the entire evening talking about the Incarnation as well, is that in the Incarnation, Jesus is fully human. Right? Fully divine, fully human. That's a necessary affirmation for Orthodox Christology, for our understanding of soteriology and even the gospel to work out. Jesus has to become one of us. If he has not become one of us, he has not, in fact, saved us. So the full humanity of Christ in the Incarnation is a fundamental postulate of the gospel. We do not have good news if the Savior remains separate from us. It only becomes good news when God becomes one of us, enters into our midst, takes our full humanity upon himself. That was, you know, the task of the early church was to think through why that was so important and defend it so vociferously. Jesus must be fully human. At the same time, though, they argued that Jesus had to be truly human. And here they had to think through a rather significant implication. when you bring deity and humanity together, does the humanity remain humanity? Or does it get transformed in some kind of way, in which you're kind of in an abstract conceptual sense? He was fully human, but not really like us. Right? He was human in a different way than we're human. No, again, it came back to he had to be fully human and truly human, or we don't have good news. He did not come to save us. Now, at the same time, he had to wrestle with the whole sinlessness question. And the conclusion was that he is fully human and truly human specifically because he is sinless. He is the only one who could step in and become fully human, entering into our human state, and restore us to that which we are supposed to be because he is sinless and therefore truly human. If he was fallenly human, broken and sinful like we are when he entered into our sinful state, not terribly hopeful. And now in modern theology, there are some debates about whether or not that's the best way to do it, but in the history of theology, that's been the consistent affirmation. Jesus must be fully human, he must be truly human, or we do not have good news. And then we get to the image of God. I put it in Latin so you feel like you get your money's worth. The Imago Dei, the image of God. And the reason I put that here, since we're talking about Jesus revealing what it means to be human, we start with that he's fully human in the incarnation, he's truly human in the incarnation, or we do not have gospel, but we also have to recognize that really in the history of Christian thinking about the human person, the image of God has always been central. I don't know about you, but I'm probably going to pay rather close attention to the first words out of God's mouth when I see him face to face. I don't know what those words would be. I'm rather terrified of what those words might be. But the first thing God says about you are probably important and worth paying attention to. The first thing God says when he creates humans is image of God. And that sets the starting point for, 2,000 years of Christian reflection on what it means to be human. Because we're so convinced that the first thing he says doesn't matter. And we've been wrestling ever since about what does he mean from Genesis 1 about being made in the image of God. But in the context of that conversation, we have to take seriously the fact that when we get to the New Testament authors are firmly convinced that fundamental affirmation the biblical authors made about the image of God only finds its true meaning in Jesus. Right? It's Jesus, the Son, who is the image of the invisible God. We are conformed to the image of the Son and transformed into his image. If you look up every reference to the image or any image language in the New Testament, almost all of them actually refer directly to the Son. The New Testament perspective on the image is that Jesus is the image of God, and we are lucky and blessed if we get to be brought into the image of Jesus. So from the New Testament perspective, this fundamental affirmation about what it means to be human, to be made in the image of God, is a Christological statement. To be made in the image of God is fundamentally a statement about Jesus, who defines, demonstrates, and reveals what it means to be made in the image of God. Now, none of that does us really any good, because we haven't the vaguest idea what the image of God is, right? We know that whatever it is, it's in Jesus, but that's relatively abstract and unhelpful at this stage of the conversation. We have kind of a theological framework within which to operate and do a theological anthropology. We're going to need to unpack this image idea a little bit more, and therefore enter into a conversation that Christians have been having for a long time. So let's see if we can't help with this idea. One of the starting points for Christian reflection on what it means to be in the image of God is the relationship between humans and other creatures. And I think it comes from the fact that in Genesis 1, humans are the only ones who are ever said to be made in the image of God. So right out of the gate, we're thinking, all right, not entirely clear on what this whole image thing is all about, but whatever it is, it seems to be something that has to do with humans being unique and different from the rest of creatures. So a fairly large portion of the Christian tradition has invested its intellectual energy into defining the image on the basis of what differentiates humans from other creatures. Now, that's not the only logic on this one, though. There is a reverse logic that kind of looks at what also makes us like God. And what puts the human person kind of in this mediating position that we kind of see in Genesis 1, where we're like God, but not like the creatures. So we get lots of discussion about, well, we seem to be smarter than other animals. So maybe what distinguishes, what is essential to the image is our intellectual, rational capacity. The fact that we seem to have a unique mental capacity that is not shared by other creatures. That was a common assumption across the ancient world. If you look at Aristotle's classic definition of what it means to be human, he defines it as rational animals. Animals according to many of our capacities, but rational, that's distinct. That's unique. So many early Christians kind of latched on to that and said, well, God is rational, so we're like him in that sense. Animals, not so much. So that seems like a great way to define the image. They had other proposals on the table. They thought about the fact that humans seem to exercise a unique kind of free will. We seem to be the kinds of beings who can utilize all kinds of other capacities to go about doing new and unique and sometimes disastrously bad things in the world. And creatures, even though they sometimes do weird things, they seem to operate in more instinctual, deterministic kinds of ways. So maybe it's free will that really sets us apart from creatures and makes us like God, right, who also freely does things. Right? Nobody tells God what to do. God determines for himself what to do. Or maybe it's our capacity for creativity. Right? God creates. He made the heavens and the earth. He spoke everything into existence. Creatures do stuff, but it's a little bit harder to call it creation. I don't know, when we leave for the evening and my dog gets into the garbage and tears stuff up and leaves it all over the floor, maybe there's a pattern to that that's creative in my dog's mind. I'm not clear on that. But creativity seems to be somewhat unique to the human person, so maybe it's our capacity for creativity that really sets us apart from creatures and makes us like God. Right? That's the logic that tends to go through this whole way of thinking. And it's a way of understanding the image, really defines the image of God in terms of our capacities. Do we have a distinct set of capacities that sets us apart from creatures, makes us like God, and that's fundamentally what it means to be made in the image of God? Now, I have to admit, there's a part of me that resonates with this understanding of the image. Partly because I can understand the logic behind the question of, is there something that sets us apart from creatures, and are there things that makes us like God? The logic of the question makes a lot of sense. And I'm kind of wired for interdisciplinary dialogue, right? I like to talk to people from different areas of specialization, look at things from different directions. And this way of understanding the imago Dei is beautiful for interdisciplinary dialogue, right? All I have to do is say the image of God is all about rationality, and then any of you studying anything having to do with intellectuality, mental capacities, rationality, cognitive function, whatever it might be, we now have a great basis for conversation. A couple of important problems, though, as we look at this one as a way of understanding the image of God. One that seems slightly problematic to me is that it's really difficult to find any basis for this understanding of the image of God anywhere in the Bible. Period. You look at any reference to the image of God anywhere in the Bible, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, I cannot find any reference to the image of God in the Bible anywhere that connects the image of God to a particular capacity of the human person. It simply does not do it. That, to me, is a bit of a problem. Right? I'm going to allow the Bible to define its own terms and concepts when it speaks about the human person or really about anything. But I need to make seriously the fact that the biblical authors at least do not explicitly unpack the image of God in terms of capacities. Problem number one. Problem number two, in the conversation about capacities, and you all know far more about this than I do, you do run into a little bit of a problem if you use this way of thinking to say that there's a particular capacity that makes us unique from all other creatures. What do you do with all of the data and evidence and research that challenges that understanding of human uniqueness on the basis of that capacity? And I'm sure you spend all evening talking about those kinds of research and those kinds of challenges, but I think in terms of rationality, is it true that human persons are the only persons that exercise any capacity for rationality? As I understand the data, that's a really difficult claim to maintain. We can say that human persons are maybe quantitatively distinct, right? We maybe exercise greater capacity for rationality than other creatures do. But is that adequate for grounding the kind of claim that we're making with respect to the image of God? Right? It's not that we're actually unique. It's just that we're kind of cooler in the sense of our rationality. The language of the image, as we use it in theology, tends not to function that way. We tend to use it in a way that suggests that there actually is something fundamentally unique about the human person, not simply quantitatively unique. And many of the discussions that go on in the interdisciplinary dialogue with respect to human capacities in this context raise the question of whether or not we actually are talking about qualitative distinctiveness, or whether we're only talking about quantitative distinctiveness. And I realize that raises the question of whether or not quantitative distinctiveness merits so far that we begin saying, well, now we have qualitative distinctiveness. Like, I'm so much smarter than a hamster that we eventually want to talk about qualitative distinctiveness. But it raises the question we want to wrestle with. And it's a challenge that the capacitative understanding of Imago Dei has not adequately addressed in the history of theology, because, of course, it's only been relatively recently that we have understood these particular challenges to this way of understanding the image. The third important thing you want to keep in mind is whether this was intended by people who are understanding the image of God in this way or not, this way of understanding the image of God has often been used to challenge, undermine, question, or implicitly suggest otherwise about the true humanity of particular groups of human persons. If being human is fundamentally about being rational, being moral, being free, all of these capacities, what do we do about people who aren't? Or people who do not appear to exercise the same capacitative level of rationality that I have, which is rather arrogant statement all by itself, I realize. So in the history of theology, I understand there's been a tendency to ask questions about whether or not so-and-so is truly in the image of God, with the underlying implication that maybe not truly human, because they're not fully exemplifying the capacities that I associate with the image of God. So I think there are some important questions that we want to ask about this approach. Although it's conducive to interesting interdisciplinary dialogue, is it really the best way to go about understanding what it means to make the image of God? Which is, like many theologians in the modern world, just jettison. Not at all uncommon to find modern theologians critiquing and rejecting the capacity, sometimes referred to as a structural or substantial understanding of the image of God. Many theologians embracing a relational approach to the image of God. Really building out of the idea that in Genesis 1, the first thing that God says after, let us make humans in our image, is male and female, he created them. So drawing the conclusion that maybe it's that latter clause, that latter statement, that really defines the prior statements. What does it mean to be made in the image of God? Well, it means not to be an individual autonomous person, which I forgot to mention, the capacity view also is rather individualistic. Right? I have all of my capacities as a human person, irrespective of all of you. I don't want to be rude, but you could all go away, and I still have all of those capacities. That hasn't changed. So the capacity view tends to be rather individualistic. The relational view says, no, right out of the gate, right after God says, image of God, this is male and female. So maybe the idea is we were never intended to be image of God alone. we were intended to be the image of God in partnership. Oftentimes, even reading back into the statement right before that, where God said, let us make. And drawing some implications from that, that maybe the us there is a reference to the triune nature of God. And God being a triunity of personal relations, it shouldn't surprise us that He created us to image Him in the context of personal relations. And of course, we jump over to Genesis 2, we have what is probably one of the most shocking statements in the creation narrative, where God looks at that which He has just created. Genesis 2:17 says it's not good. Right? Adam alone in the garden, after a series of it is good, it is good, it is good, in Genesis 1, all the way through the creation narratives, Genesis 2:17, God looks at what He Himself created and said it is not good. And it is not good precisely because it's not done. And it's not good until Adam and Eve are brought together at the end of Genesis chapter 2. They come together in one flesh. And then we really have the completion of the creation narrative in Genesis. Not human individual, but human community. People in relationship to one another. So many theologians, the relational view now is probably the most prominent understanding of the image of God among Christian systematic theologians. So it's not fundamentally about capacities, it's fundamentally about our relationships, our relationality, the fact that God created us in community. Which would be great if it worked. Couple of problems as we reflect back on the image of God. One might be, one that I would want to introduce into the conversation. If you look at Genesis 1, when God said, let's make humans in our image, that He created them, and He created them male and female, it is not entirely clear or obvious that the male and female in that context is intended as a definition of the image of God. So much as an emphasis that all humans are made in the image of God. And when we get to the next one, we'll see it's actually rather important to realize that in the culture that the Bible was written in, there was an image of God concept. We'll get to that in the next one. It wasn't unusual to hear people talking about particular individuals being made in the image of God. But in the other cultures, image of God was exclusive. Only certain people were made in the image of God. What the Genesis narrative does that's so shocking and surprising is it says, no. Not just particular individuals get to be the image of God. Everybody gets to be the image of God. All humans, male and female, are made in the image of God. So it's not entirely clear from Genesis 1 that male and female there is intended to define the image of God in terms of relationality. So much as to emphasize that the universality of the image, whatever the image is, we all get to participate in it. And of course, there are all kinds of complex arguments around the let us and whether or not Christians should really be reading Trinity back into the very first chapter of the Old Testament, which, just in case you're not aware of that, tends to annoy virtually every Jewish interpreter on the planet. So for at least a couple of reasons, we want to be cautious with the relationality view and moving too quickly in that direction. And again, one last thing on that one, we should be mindful of the fact relationality itself also, by the way, creates great opportunities for interdisciplinary dialogue. Right? I would love to just jump on the relationality bandwagon. Virtually every social science now recognizes the importance of human-created relationships and interpersonal dynamics. So if relationality is at the core of the human person, now we have a great opportunity to create dialogue between theological anthropology and other approaches to anthropology. But I do want to be mindful of the fact that the relational view to the image of God became really popular around the mid-1800s. Right about the time that culturally an emphasis on relationality became really popular. Right, you have the rise of things like cultural anthropology, sociology, psychology, and the philosophy of personalist understanding of the human person. See, culturally, a lot of dynamics that set the stage for us to be inclined to read biblical texts in ways that emphasize relationality. That doesn't make it wrong. It just should set up some red flags, saying, was this really how these texts were meant to be read? Or have we just been culturally conditioned to see relational themes in them that may not have been there otherwise? A question that seems important to ask. I shall now begin speaking faster. The image of God as function. This one, I said the relational image is super popular among theologians. The image of God as function is by far the most common way of reading the image of God among the biblical scholars, particularly Old Testament scholars. I consider one of my jobs as a theologian to point out to all of my theologian friends, when they talk about the image of God in terms of relationality, that they are actually disagreeing with the vast majority of biblical scholars, and particularly Old Testament scholars, for the last at least 100 years or so. So if we're going to be biblically minded as theologians, it would seem important that we pay attention to what the biblical scholars are saying. And they're all saying this is the way to go. And the way to get there is to point out that the image of God in Genesis 1 really dropped into the text without explanation. Generally speaking, when an author does that, the author is either an idiot or expects that you know what is going on. You understand the words that are being used. Let's assume the latter of those options is true in this case. And the author thinks that the readers will know what image of God means. If we look in the broader culture, I mentioned we see image of God language getting used. And it's often used, depending on the cultural context that you take. In the Egyptian context, it's either used of kings or pharaohs as stewards, vicars, representatives of a divine being ruling on earth in place of the divine being. Or in the Mesopotamian context, it's generally the high priests serving that same function, right? Ruling, representatives, serving, I don't want to say vicaring, whatever the verb form of that would be. In place of the divine being on earth. So it's not so much about the capacities that they have or the relationships that they're in, so much as the function that they're carrying out. They've been designated as God's royal representatives in creation. So if that's what it meant to the broader culture, if the biblical author just kind of dropped that into the text without explanation, then maybe we're supposed to read it that way. And of course, as you read through Genesis 1, right after the image of God and the male and female, we get the reference to rule over the earth. So right in the context, we have a reference to the kind of dominion functional language that this approach understands. If you fast forward to Psalm 8, kind of a more poetic language talking about the human person, you get the same kind of expression. That we've been created a little bit lower than the angels, but a little bit higher than creation. Very royal dominion stewardship type language going on in Psalm 8 as well. And then maybe that's what's happening here in the text. So based on kind of more of an exegetical argument and an ancient Near Eastern context argument, many of the biblical scholars will argue that this is the best way to understand the image. I'm going to suggest, because of course I'm right, everyone else is wrong. No, what I'm about to say is actually just piecing together in a slightly different way the functional approach. Right? It actually draws on a lot of what's going on here, but comes at it from a slightly different angle in agreement with a variety of other Old Testament scholars, that really the best way to understand the image is simply in terms of representation. Now, the functional approach builds off the concept of representation, right? Pharaoh rules on the earth as a representative of the divine being. So the functional kind of draws off the logic of the representation. So all I'm doing, I think, is backing up a step and saying that the functional approach, the let them rule, isn't a definition of the image, it's a consequence of the image. As those made to represent God, let them rule. So the functional approach isn't so wrong as it is not getting at the heart necessarily of what the image is fundamentally about. I think one of the reasons that we have a hard time understanding the image of God language, biblically speaking, is because as Western Americans, we have a really hard time understanding the concept of the symbol. We have really weak views of symbol and how symbol functions. So that we use language like, it's just a symbol, or it's merely a symbol, because we think the symbolic representations manifest relatively weak connections between the symbol and whatever it is that it's symbolizing. And so if I sketched on the whiteboard if a map of the United States, which, by the way, would be hardly recognizable as a map of the United States, but if I did that, you would recognize that my drawing was kind of symbolic of the United States. But if I erased the map, you wouldn't be terribly bothered by that. It's not like you feel like there's any direct connection between the symbol that I've constructed and the reality that it seeks to represent. Because we're rather satisfied with weak connections between symbols and realities. The best that I've been able to come up with to help us see a deeper, more important connection between symbols and reality would be if I actually kind of taped up on the whiteboard here a white piece of cloth, really two white pieces of cloth, and on this one over here on the right, I just randomly splashed some paint on it, right? So that it didn't make any noticeable color or whatnot. And then on this one, I took exactly the same amount and color of paint, but I painted it in the shape of stars and stripes and blue fields. So that this one is just cloth and paint, and this one is American flag. Now, to deepen my analysis a little bit further, suppose that I'm slightly, I don't know about suicidal, but open to danger. I pull out of my pocket a lighter, and I burn this one, and nobody responds. And then I burn this one. My guess is I get a significantly more visceral, emotional, important reaction when I burn a flag of the United States. Even though they're both, viewed from one perspective, just cloth and paint. And actually, exactly the same kind of cloth and exactly the same kind of paint. And it's because we recognize that there's a difference. Because one of them symbolizes. Right? There's a real connection in that instance between the symbol and the reality that it seeks to represent. So that what I do to that symbol signifies something about what I'm doing with respect to the reality that lies behind the symbol. We need to push beyond mere symbolism and understand the idea of a real symbolism if we're going to have any concept of what the Bible is talking about when it talks about idols. We struggle with this one as well, a little bit, I think, because those of us who understand Isaiah's or Bill Bobbitt's rhetoric against idols, if you read Isaiah's comments about idols, he's got fabulous passages where he's just mocking idols. He's pointing out, really, you're going to take this metal, and with your own two hands, you're going to fashion it and form it so that it makes a statue, and now you're going to worship it. Oh, that makes perfect sense. So that right here, it's just metal. And right here, it's idol that should be worshipped. How dumb can you possibly get? The problem, and as rhetoric, it works powerfully well, because of course Isaiah wants them to think and realize that their gods are not real gods. But Isaiah knows full well that there is an important difference between the metal here and the metal here. This is lump of unformed metal, like cloth with random paint splashed upon it. This is an idol. A symbol with a tangible, powerful connection to the reality that it seeks to represent. In the ancient world, the idols would actually go through a ceremony. And it was in the ceremony, not just the fashioning with your hands, it was in the ritualistic ceremony, the religious ceremony, the god was understood to come and invest the idol with its presence. that's when it became not merely metal, but real tangible symbol, an idol, through which a divine being would make its reality present in the world. If we can't wrap our heads around the concept of a real symbol with deep meaning and connection to the reality that it seeks to symbolize, we will struggle to understand what the biblical authors are doing with the concept of idol. My favorite story for unpacking this has to be the story where the Israelites go into battle against the Philistines and they're terrified they're going to lose. Because they're well aware of the fact they've been living rebelliously for a while now. And they're not at all confident that God will just kind of stick up for them. So their solution to this, in their brilliance, is to take the ark into battle with them. Because they recognize that the ark is not just a pretty box. The ark is an intentionally constructed physical artifact through which God has decided to make his presence tangibly present in the world. It's not random cloth and paint, it's meaningful symbol. And they're taking that meaningful symbol in with them into battle. Now, sadly for the Israelites, this does not go at all well. They get completely annihilated in the battle. The ark gets captured. They might have wanted to keep in mind the fact that just having an idol doesn't mean you actually control the deity that the idol is connected to. And that's not how idols work. They forgot that bit. So they lose the battle. The ark gets captured. But the Philistines also know how idols work. They have an understanding of symbols and the deep connection that symbols have to reality. So they take the ark, they bring it into the temple of their god Dagon, and they place it at his feet. Because they know full well that this is not a pretty box sitting on the floor next to neat statue. This is symbol of your god defeated at the foot of the physical presence of our god in the world. That's the kind of thing that we have to wrap our heads around if we will understand a deeper concept of symbol, the biblical concept of idol, and then ultimately, I think, what the Bible is talking about when it refers to language of image. Conceptually speaking, symbol, image, and idol are in the same semantic range. Actually, used rather interchangeably in the Old Testament. When the Bible talks about us as being images, it's not doing anything different than when it talks about something as being a symbol or something as being an idol. Now, idol language, I want to be a little bit careful here as I've picked up over the years. Of course, idol language is almost universally used negatively in the Bible. So I don't want to suggest that we should be worshiping humans. If you're curious, that's bad in biblical concept. But the conceptual framework is the same. Physical thing through which some greater reality makes its presence tangibly experienced in creation. That is symbol, image, idol. That's the concept biblically instructed. So why did the biblical authors feel free to drop image into Genesis 1 without explanation? Well, it's because they knew that all of their readers were operating with a very robust understanding of how symbol, image, idol worked. That to refer to something as a symbol or an image of a divine being meant that they were the physical, tangible media through which that divine being would make himself felt, experienced, and present in the world. And then if we draw some connections then, I think this has important implications for the capacity view of the image of God, in the sense that I do think in the theology science conversation, we want to have lots of dialogue about human capacities. I just think it's important to recognize that, as far as I can tell, capacity has nothing to do with image. Look at it this way: if I take two statues and place them on this counter here, actually, I'm talking with my high school students about this, they use stuffed animals, right? So I put one stuffed animal here and one stuffed animal over here, and I say that one's an idol because some divine being has decided to make its presence tangibly experienced through that one. Is there any real difference between that stuffed animal and that one?
No, it's not like God thought, well, the humans are super cool, the hamsters are just weird and small, so I'm going to manifest my presence through the humans and not the hamsters. Are we getting that same language in Daniel when Nebuchadnezzar makes a statue of himself? And the statue represents him, so the people are supposed to bow down to it. There's nothing cool about the statue that makes that statue more important than any other statue in the world. The statue has no particular intrinsic capacities that makes it the case that the statue manifests Nebuchadnezzar's presence in the city. The statue manifests Nebuchadnezzar's presence in the city because Nebuchadnezzar decided that it would. We image God in creation not because of our capacities. We have capacities, we can talk about those. It's not our capacities that manifest God's presence in the world. As though we can make God present in the world. God images himself through us. And to me, that then answers the question, well, what about those human persons who don't seem to exercise the same kinds of capacities that I do? Or seem to have defective capacities? Or haven't learned how to utilize their capacities all the way? So, imaging God has nothing to do with our capacities. God images himself through us. I could go to that statue of Nebuchadnezzar and lop his head off. And if Nebuchadnezzar wants it to, it's still imaging or representing Nebuchadnezzar in that city. And I'm in a lot of trouble. The only way that that statue stops imaging, representing Nebuchadnezzar, is if Nebuchadnezzar says, no longer. The only way that we stop imaging God in creation is if God himself says, no longer. Now, what about the whole relationship there? I've already said that I'm a little bit skeptical about using male and female in Genesis 1, but I haven't talked much yet about Christology. I've got to connect my dots here. If Jesus Christ is at the core of this conversation, two things I want to say here. One, Jesus works really, really well for me in terms of manifesting God's presence in creation. Is that not a definition of the incarnation? God becoming present in creaturely form, the fullness of deity manifest in bodily form, the exact representation of his nature. That's explicit language from Paul and Hebrews. The incarnation simply is a definition of what I've just finished explaining about symbol, idol, and image. So if we use Jesus as our starting point of what it means to be human, and therefore what it means to be the image, we have to take seriously the fact that when Jesus came, he did not come as an individual, did a bunch of individually cool stuff, and then left. Jesus came and constituted people. He came and formed people. He called those people into union with himself through the power of the Spirit. And if we fast forward to the end of the story, we are not done with this story until God is present in his Son through the power of the Spirit with his people in the new creation forever. So I think we can get everything the relationality that it wants to have there, but we get there not by looking at the male and female in Genesis 1, but by looking at Jesus Christ and saying that as human persons, we are fundamentally ecclesial beings. We were created for the church to be brought into union with the Son and to live with him forever as his image bearers in creation. So what? All right. Really fast. What? Not that fast. What we get if we do that on the so what is, I think, a deeply theological framework for understanding the human person. If that all of what I just got done saying is true, and if those affirmations are necessary for understanding fully, truly, ultimately what it means to be human, then the human person is a theological, Christological, pneumatological, ecclesiological, and eschatological being. There's no way around that. We're not done understanding the human person unless we've seen the human person in that context. Christ. What does this mean for interdisciplinary dialogue? This would seem to create rather significant problems for interdisciplinary dialogue. If I'm going to sit down with my cognitive neuroscientist friend, I'm saying, everything that I just got done sharing is the starting point for understanding the human person. If you're not going to understand the human person through that lens, you're wrong. So go on about your business, go do your thing. As soon as you become a Christian, study some theology, really learn church history, come to understand the depths of the Trinity and the Incarnation and the church and eschatology and whatnot, then come back to me, and now we can have a meaningful conversation about what it means to be human. It sounds silly, but if we're not careful, right, if we overemphasize too much this, the necessity of this theological framework, we put ourselves in what they also refer to as the theological ghetto. Right, locked away from any other perspective on what it means to be human. And we have really neat conversations amongst ourselves. And over at the BGC 5-4, right? We can have great conversations, we can hang out there, we can get paid and do our thing, and never make our way over to this building where other conversations are happening. Right? Where's the dialogue?
Well, real dialogue only happens when we recognize that both people involved in the dialogue have unique contributions.
There's nothing about what I have said so far that says that other perspectives on the human person can't have unique contributions about what it means to be human. All I've said is that as a Christian, really, not just a theologian, but as a Christian, I also have unique contributions to bring to the table. And I'm going to hear your contributions, engage your contributions in the context of my contribution. That's a conversation. I don't have to put mine away or ignore them. You don't have to either. We're going to put them both on the table and we're going to talk about them. Which means, in the conversation, there will be some surrender of control. I don't get to say, no, that doesn't get to be put on the table. I get to say, I will assess it and think about it and reflect upon it, utilizing the resources of my own unique starting points. But I don't get to say, no, that's not a valid object of consideration. That's not a real conversation. There's no expectation that one party or the other will be automatically assumed to give in the conversation. Now, I'll admit, I will enter the conversation assuming that my starting point is right. But that doesn't mean that I expect the other person in the conversation to automatically capitulate to everything that I say. And vice versa, I expect the same. Right? That if I'm having that conversation with a cognitive neuroscientist, I don't expect to have to capitulate on my theological convictions on the basis of their particular starting point. At the same time, we want both active listening and willingness to learn if we're going to have a real conversation. Even though I end the conversation, thinking my unique contribution is in fact legitimate, valid, and necessary, otherwise why would I bring it to the table? I want to engage the conversation with the willingness to have my contribution shaped and molded by the conversation. If they do in fact have a unique contribution to bring, that should be my expectation. Again, that's why I'm having a conversation, not a lecture. Which is an enforcing statement to make as I'm doing a lecture. But a conversation comes with the expectation that we'll both bring something to the table. And at the end of the day, from our unique contributions, hopefully we both walk away with something having been learned. So there's nothing I think about what I said that precludes any of this. It just emphasizes the fact that theologians do in fact bring something unique. And that is not an obvious or intuitive assumption. I mentioned earlier when I tell people I study theological anthropology that one of the first questions is, or one of the first responses is, right, they know what theological is. I generally hope they won't ask follow-up questions. So it takes way too long to explain the theological bit of that. But if somebody's really kind of intentional and they pursue it long enough and they want the theological and I explain it, I notice that even among Christians, a fair number of people, as soon as they know what I'm talking about by theological anthropology, they're immediately uninterested. And it's because they don't believe that theology has a unique contribution to make in a conversation about what it means to be human. And so we struggle with kind of, I wonder if on the theology side we struggle because theologians are notorious for not listening to people from other disciplines. But oftentimes the conversation is hard because people coming from other perspectives don't think theology has any meaningful contribution to the conversation either. And we end up not having no conversations as a result.
So what does this look like in practice? What am I down to? Oh, and unfortunately I'm out of time. All right. On the mind-body debate. We use this as our case study, and we may have to do this a little bit more in the Q&A, so I'll go through this, unfortunately, simply. One of the things I want to say first, when I use mind-body as a case study for interdisciplinary dialogue, I find that many people respond fairly quickly with, why bother? Because the Bible is so clear that there is a body and there is a soul, so we are talking about some kind of substance dualism. The Bible decides the question for us. There's really no need for dialogue. All we have to do is correct everybody else that they see what's going on here. So quickly, I just want to say, well, pretty much no. And the phrase that I often use here is that the Bible is underdetermined on the ontology of the human person. In other words, the Bible says a lot about the human person, but it doesn't give us the kind of theoretical specificity that we would want to have to walk away with a definitive understanding about exactly what's going on at the ontological level of the human person. So we get lots of body-soul language. Surprisingly, though, if you chase down most of the body-soul language in the Bible, it, on both sides, body and soul, is primarily there to emphasize the whole human person. Body is rarely used to emphasize just the physical and external. Soul is rarely used to emphasize kind of some immaterial substance that hangs out with the physical stuff. Most commonly, body is just meant to indicate that we live in a physical world, creatures, right? We live in a physical, creaturely world. Soul is the language primarily used to emphasize that we're living beings. We're not inanimate beings. We're animate beings. And in that sense, we're no different in being souled beings than our paradigmatic hamster is, which is also animate. So even if you look at Genesis 1 and 2, Genesis 2, 7, when God breathes the breath of life into the human person, and the human person becomes a living being. The living being phrase there is the exact same Hebrew phrase that's used in Genesis 1 to describe the land animals. And we are animate beings as opposed to inanimate beings. So body-soul language, primarily in the Bible, is meant to emphasize together that we're holistic beings animated in a physical world. That's how the language functions. Flesh-spirit language, let's get a little bit more complicated. Spirit language primarily gets used in the Bible to emphasize the fact that as humans, we are created to be in relationship with God. So that spirituality is me living out my humanity in the ways that God intended. That's what it means to be a spiritual being. To be a fleshly being can get used either positively or negatively. Positively, it begins to be a creature. Right? I have flesh because I'm a creature, not an eternal, invisible, immortal God. It gets used negatively when it's used in kind of contrast to spiritually. Instead of living my creaturely life in orientation toward God, I live my creaturely life in orientation away from God. So I neglect my reality as creature and image bearer, and I live toward the things of this earth exclusively. That's what it means to live out the desires of the flesh, to use Paul's language in that sense. Rarely, if ever, do we see flesh-spirit language used in the kind of ontological sense that we have in mind when we talk about body-soul. It's not generally talking about parts of the human person. So much as ways in which the human person lives and expresses its humanity in the world. Inner-outer functions very much the same way. Not dualistic so much, just recognizing that when I think, feel, emote, will, do all kinds of things, you don't see that happen. Right? Those are inner realities. What you see happening are outer realities. That's not necessarily intended to designate dualistic divide between my body and some immaterial substance,
but just that there's stuff that you can see and stuff that you can't see.
I'm not even going to go there. We do have some eschatological questions that often come into play. I'll just say at this point that let's be careful about using eschatological realities that are A, mysterious, and B, rarely mentioned in Scripture to drive our understanding of the human person. Let's lead with what the Bible talks about a lot, and then try to figure out what it only talks about every now and then. Theologians have often done it precisely the reverse. So we lead with the intermediate state and resurrection, and then read all of the rest of the stuff through that lens. Now, I'm not saying that none of this is interesting, significant, actually even fun. It's all relevant for understanding the human person. But there are debates on all of these issues precisely because they're undetermined. Right? There are different ways of reading the text. And maybe when we get to questions, we can. If you have specific questions, if you have questions about specific texts, you have questions about, we can talk about them. Developing a Christological framework on all of this, right? How exactly do we build a Christological framework for engaging specific issues in anthropology on this basis? First thing I want to say is you need to recognize that there are differences between Jesus and us. There's no simple move from Christology to anthropology, precisely because Jesus is, I don't know, God. Rather important difference that needs to be taken into account. We've already mentioned the sinlessness factor, so the humanity I see in Christ is importantly different from the humanity that I see in myself and, sorry, all the rest of you. There are significant differences. So however we understand the relationship between Christology and anthropology, it's not as simple as what would Jesus do. Right? I don't get to just look at Jesus and immediately draw conclusions because there are important differences that we need to take into account. But I do in fact look at Jesus. If this is going to be a Christological framework, then even recognizing those differences, I do study Jesus. See, what do I learn about Jesus? And as a result, what affirmations do I have to make about what it means to be human because of what I see in Jesus? That's how the logic has to function. There's no natural, immediate, simple move from Christology to anthropology. But if I look at Jesus and I say, if affirmation A is true, then what I see in Jesus is false. I need to come back to affirmation A and reflect on it some more. Or come back around to what I think I saw in Jesus. I guess it works both ways, right? But that's how the logic has to work. Relative to the mind-body debate, some things that I think are necessary Christological affirmations.
Things I must be able to say if Jesus is who he has revealed himself to be. Humans must be embodied. There must be some kind of continuous identity. Jesus must be the same yesterday, today, and forever. Jesus must be the same person before the resurrection and after the resurrection. If I may make any sense out of the Gospels. He must have some kind of relational selfhood. And I phrase it that way intentionally. Right? There is, in the Gospel narrative, there's a clear sense that Jesus has a selfhood. It has a concept of himself as a person who we'll get into agency and other things. There seems to be a clear sense in which Jesus himself operates with some concept of personhood or selfhood. But it's not an individualistic notion. It's really difficult to read the gospel narratives and walk away with any sense that Jesus' concept of himself is individualistically constructed. Right? He spends his entire life on people and consciously uses people and as himself. So whatever his selfhood is, it's a relational self. Did I get them all? All right, I'm going to operate on the tenuous assumption that you have all at least heard of the varieties of physicalism and dualism. Right, there are lots of different kinds. We're going to spend longer talking about physicalism and dualism and views of the human person. One of the things that I often want to make sure that we do is we don't think of those as singular entities. As though physicalism is one discrete thing and dualism is one discrete thing. There are many varieties of physicalism. that ranged all the way from what's often called eliminative physicalism, the kind of physicalism that says that not only are we physical beings, but we are so physical that we really should get rid of any language of mental, emotional, spiritual. All of that is not only illusory, but it's deceptive and harmful. So let's get rid of it. Let's do our best to only talk about the human person in physical, and by physical I mean almost in the language of the physics. Like that's really the only legitimate language that we have available to us. All the way down to emergent physicalism, which begins to sound an awful lot like dualism. Right? We're fundamentally physical beings, but any complex interaction of physical realities inside of the physical being, complex processes produce higher level complex processes, which produce even higher level complex processes. And all the way up, we end up with things like minds and minds and relationships in societies and whatnot. There are important realities in their own rights that we need to talk about. So a whole range of physicalism. We can do the same thing on dualism. I find this one to be even more important because many people today have no concept that there are different kinds of dualism. They range all the way from Platonic Cartesian dualism to separate the physical and the spiritual in very dichotomous, certainly distinctive kinds of ways, and are often the kinds of dualism that we have in mind when we critique dualism or read criticism of dualism, all the way down to emergent and Thomistic dualism, which sound awfully physicalistic. And they so emphasize the necessity of the human person. In Thomistic dualism, there is no human person apart from body. The soul can continue with some kind of existence, but you do not talk about the human person existing apart from the union of body and soul. That's what constitutes the human person. So, large range of physicalisms, large range of dualisms. When I talk about the relationship between this robust theological, Christological framework and these specific mind-body theories, I'm talking about asking questions like, does a particular theory, like Cartesian dualism or emergent physicalism, make what I see as the necessary affirmations? In other words, those affirmations that we went through about embodiment, relational selfhood, continuous identity, right? Necessary Christological affirmations. Does a particular theory make those affirmations? Can it say the kinds of things that it seems to me we have to say about the human person in light of who Jesus is? Question number one. Question number two, can it do so coherently? There are a variety of options on the table that make the affirmations. It's just not entirely clear that they're fully coherent in doing so. And I'll comment on that in a second. Oh, and that last one is just anything else you might want to keep in mind. That's my catch-all question. So, reductive physicalism, if I'm assessing an eliminative or reductive approach to the human person, I'm actually not going to take terribly long at it because reductive physicalists make, there are a number of places where they don't make the necessary Christological affirmations. They simply won't affirm human agency, at least not in a way that I think makes any sense. They won't refer responsibility. Many of them specifically deny the concept of human self or a person, or a continuous personal identity. Right? Oftentimes we'll talk about those things as myths or things. Stories that we tell ourselves because they have a useful function, but there's no real meaning or reality behind them. Right? So they're not making necessary Christological affirmations. Important for me, though, as I'm talking about interdisciplinary dialogue, is to point out that that doesn't mean I tell them to shut up. Right? That's not a conversation. If I'm having a conversation, remember, I don't get to tell them what they put on the table or what issues they get to raise. What I can say is from my Christological starting point, that is fundamentally Christologically inadequate, and there's no way that I'm going to embrace that as an adequate way of understanding the human person. So I'm going to raise all kinds of important questions about it that need to be addressed. If they want to continue to research and try to strengthen their perspective in response to those objections, I'm not going to question or critique that. It may be, I'll be honest, I have no clue how anybody could possibly develop a reductive anthropology that would be Christologically adequate. I can't even wrap my head around how that might happen. But I could be wrong. So why would I tell them to stop pursuing it? We can keep the conversation going, and I can keep pointing out why I think it's fundamentally wrong-headed. But we can keep the conversation going. As opposed to non-reductive physicalism, which, as far as I can tell, all of the non-reductive physicalists, these people say we're fundamentally physical, but we do have these higher level realities that we want to affirm, like minds and souls and whatnot, so they're non-reductive. They'll make all the necessary affirmations, I'm just not entirely clear that they can do so coherently. Is it possible for us to be fully physical beings and actually exercise the kind of meaningful agency that we seem to see operating in the person of Christ on the atonement, on the cross, in the atonement, right, where he freely and voluntarily goes to the cross? I'm not clear on that. People operating in this camp have written lengthy articles and books trying to explain how this works out. Still not entirely clear on it, but it is clear that they're making the affirmation. I said no. That should be yes. They're making the affirmation. They're saying all of the right things about Christology. I'm just not clear that all the pieces fit together. Which means we're absolutely still having the conversation. They're still putting the issues on the table. We're still talking and dialoguing. They're bringing their unique perspective. I'm bringing mine. I'm challenging their perspective, saying I'm not clear how that's Christologically adequate. And they're challenging mine, saying, are you sure you've got the Christology part right down right? And we're having that kind of sharpening conversation. We can do the exact same thing on the dualism side. Cartesian dualism, as far as I can tell, they missed some really important affirmations. There are some fundamentally important things about the human person that, I'll be clear here, I'm not clear that Descartes himself did this, but when you describe Cartesian dualism, it's not clear to me that we're making some fundamentally important affirmations about the human person. In particular, the necessity of human embodiment that would capture why Jesus became incarnate and why he was resurrected. Holistic dualism, a kind of dualism would emphasize more the union of body and soul, either a super close union or an inseparable union, however you want to plug that in. But a dualism that connects body and soul more closely, they are, I did it again, they are making the necessary affirmations. There are just a few places where even with them I have some questions about coherence. Here particularly, this is where the intermediate state I find interesting. There are a number of theologians or philosophers who affirm some kind of holistic dualism who will say that really we only operate fully as human persons when it's body and soul in union with one another. And then I read how they describe the human person in the intermediate state, and it sounds rather robust. We're thinking, we're worshiping, we're loving, we're relating, we're willing, we're doing all of the things that we think are important about being human, but we're not embodied. And so I just wrestle with that a little bit. You're making the necessary affirmations. You're saying that embodiment is important. But I'm not entirely clear how it all coheres in all of the different bits of your system. So let's talk some more. Let's continue the conversation and the dialogue. And we can plug away some of this otherwise. So I would say at the end of the day, a Christological anthropology provides a robust theological frame, a basis for assessing other perspectives, a normative but not exclusive perspective on the human person, and an opportunity for meaningful interdisciplinary dialogue.
Let's take about 10 more minutes. Thanks so much for all this. There's so much up there.
Let's see if we got it.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah, we got kind of fast. Whoops. Too fast again. Yeah, I'm getting there. Yeah. I backed it too far. I said I have no problem making this available, by the way. I should have said that at the beginning. So I'll send a PDF version of this to Ray.
Yes,
That would be a really good idea. That importantly changes what I'm trying to say.
How about Chuck?
Yeah. That was an excellent talk.
Thank you.
You're talking about symbols and idols and Isaiah's perspective. I'm thinking of symbols that we have in the Christian church, specifically the Eucharist.
Yeah.
The mystery of the bread and the wine and the presence of Christ. So we have different perspectives from the symbol to there's a transubstantiation. How do you handle that?
Yeah, at the very least, I come from a Baptist background,
where in my ecclesial background, very low view of the sacraments, right? That's where really a lot of my language of mere symbolism comes out of my own church background and how we talk about things like baptism and communion and whatnot. At the very least, I'll say that when I've worked with students and taught students who come from a similar background, they struggle a little bit to understand the idea of anything more than mere symbolism, which we're just talking about communion and baptism. But if I take them through this first and kind of talk through the concept of something more than merely symbolic, then take them to the sacraments, that works much better for them. So I have no problem saying that things like baptism, in fact, I think we must say that they are more than merely symbolic. I can't make any sense out of why the Bible makes them such a big deal if they're merely symbolic. But I can say that still as a Baptist. I should say I'm still a Baptist. So I have no problem with that. I think I have a more robust understanding of what symbol is. So that as a Baptist, when I say that they're symbolic, I'm not saying they're merely symbolic. I'm saying that they're robustly symbolic. They powerfully connect to and represent the reality they represent. I'm not dumb enough to say that they're sacraments in the Baptist context. So, yeah.
This is so excellent. I'm wondering, what is your plan to put this out as a book or make it a core of the book? How is that coming along?
Thank you. I've teased some of this out in the book that Ray mentioned earlier. I have a chapter on the image of God. What I haven't done in the interdisciplinary dialogue stuff comes out in the first book, which was from my my doctoral dissertation. So what I haven't done yet is connect really those two things, the image of God narrative from the second book with the interdisciplinary dialogue bit from the first book, into something that makes it more coherent presentation in its own right. And we'll see. I'm actually getting some excitement to see if there's broader interest in that.
You can look for it.
Thank you.
Some pastors, and I think our pastor actually, sometimes that human beings is just the body, soul, and spirit. I think in an attempt to reflect the Trinity in the image, gathering from what you said, you don't find that necessarily in the biblical writings. That you kind of a triune human being with the soul and spirit and body.
Right. It, to some extent, it depends on what they're doing with the language. So if you don't all hear the question, it's kind of the body-soul-spirit question. But should we understand that the human person is comprising three different elements rather than two? The quick pushback on it is it tends to draw off too quickly off of language like in 1 Thessalonians, where it refers to body, soul, and spirit. And that's kind of the classic proof text for that particular position. And the way I often respond to that is just quickly take people to other texts that either talk about the human being two parts or four parts, right? Mind, soul, strength, heart. You can do will. If you just start adding up pieces, we end up not with dualism or trichotomism, but some kind of polychotomism with just a whole bunch of different colors, right? So just on the basis of the text and language alone, I want to say, let's be careful with that. Where it could be done a little bit more helpfully, and to be honest, I rarely hear it unpacked this way, is if somebody just wants to say that they're using body language to emphasize that we're creaturely beings living in a creaturely world. I'm going to use soul language for the fact that things happen inside of me that are not visible to other people. And I'll use spiritual language for the fact that we are created to be in relationship with God, and that's fundamental to what it means to be human. And so when I say body, soul, spirit, I'm referring to those three concepts or aspects. I have much less problem with that. Yeah.
And I'm often talks about dust. You know, talking about talks about we are dust. Mm-hmm. That applies to locale. When you were going through and talking about flesh, I was thinking, that's also talking about mortality.
Yeah, that's actually the primary use of flesh. When we hear flesh, we tend to associate it with all kinds of negative connotations because Paul uses it negatively in a few places.
the predominant usage of flesh throughout the Bible, and we have to keep in mind the Old Testament authors use flesh routinely to refer to the human person. It does just mean creature, mortal, finite, not God or creatures. It only becomes negative when Paul kind of identifies that as a helpful term to talk about the creaturely person living according exclusively to creaturely realities. We're not living according to divine values. We're just living according to creaturely realities. Now we become flesh beings. And say, 1 Corinthians 15, when Paul talks about being resurrected and recreated as spiritual beings, he doesn't mean non-physical. What he means is creaturely beings now no longer living in orientation of creaturely realities, but living in line with the spirit. That's what it means to be spiritual. So it's not a dualism kind of language idea. It's more of an orientation that a spiritual being is a being living rightly, empowered by the Spirit, according to the Spirit, according to the purpose of the Spirit. So, yeah.
So, Mark, thanks so much for quite an informative talk. I'm curious about the one slide with non-physical or non-reductive physical, where you said that it meets the affirmations, but it's not coherent. So is the lack of coherence, essentially, does that boil down to, if I can put it in sort of overly simplistic terms, does that boil down to we don't have a soul, and therefore it's not coherent because somehow that soul safeguards our passage into the next world? And if that's the case, isn't the intermediate state passage, isn't there just like one reference in Scripture to that, and isn't that pinning an awful lot on that one reference?
Yeah, I actually don't use the intermediate state argument a lot. I find it interesting to speculate upon, and the texts are fun to exegete. But at the end of the day, and I'm guessing many of you know more about this than I do, even to talk about what it means to be a body, the more I kind of skim the surface of scientific literature on what physical realities are like, the less I'm certain what we mean when we talk about something to be a body. And that makes it me less confident when I say that we can't be embodied in the intermediate state, because I'm not entirely certain any longer what a body is, per se. So there are a lot of ambiguity in the intermediate state that maybe we just kind of want to set that one aside for like a coffee shop and we're hanging out and kind of chatting and whatnot. On non-reductive physicalism, two things. One, I wouldn't say that it's not coherent. The question mark on the slide was intentional. It's more, I have what I think are important questions about the coherence of non-reductive physicalism. And they do stem more from, because in non-reductive physicalism, even though it's non-reductive, we're still fundamentally physical beings constituted by physical processes.
You don't have a soul.
Not so much that, but we're constituted fundamentally by physical processes. They tend to operate a lot off where causation is entirely event causation. So anything that I do is an effect of prior causes. So there's a causal chain that's involved here. That, for me, raises important questions about things like agency and responsibility and continuous identity. I think those are all just big challenges for anybody who affirms a physicalist approach. I know they have attempted to resolve those. I just don't find the resolutions entirely satisfying. So that's more when the question mark is on there, because I know there are questions, I know they're trying to answer them, I just don't buy it yet.
I like to conclude in that Christ is the best example of what it means to be human, because we know a lot about what Christ did. Mm-hmm. But you admitted too, and we all understand, that Christ was without sin, and Christ had a divine nature, and that does make him different than us. So wouldn't a better representation of human, true human, be Adam and Eve before the fall? They were created in God's image. We knew they could sin, because they did, and they didn't have any
migration. So two things on that. That is a classic starting point for Christian theology, is to start more with Adam and Eve than with Christ. I'm hesitant with that for two reasons. One, we actually have far less information about Adam and Eve, and particularly in terms of just what it looks like. Right? We have statements about them, but we get almost no information about what their humanity actually looked like, right? How it operated, or what they did. So we end up speculating an awful lot when that becomes our starting point. I'm somewhat inclined, and there's a difference of opinion in theology on this one, I'm inclined to see the humanity of Adam and Eve in the garden as good, but not as goodable as it could possibly be. We don't have great language for it, right? But I'm inclined to think that, that there was a trajectory that Adam and Eve were intended to live out from the garden. That Adam and Eve in the garden, that wasn't kind of a static, completed state. That even in their goodness and their perfection, there was an intention for learning and growth. And part of that is just that they were created to be in relationship to an infinite God. There had to have been growth involved with that. It could not have been created with an inexhaustible understanding of the divine nature. I'm not even entirely sure what that would mean. So just in terms of the relationship with God, there had to be a trajectory established. I'm inclined to think that's actually how it works with persons in general. Right? That you don't exhaustively know any person, whether divine person or human person. That's something that unfolds on and on forever. So the fact that they were created in relationship with each other and relationship with God, to me, gives me a basis all by itself for saying that there was a trajectory that was intended to be established there. Then I can look at Jesus and say, when we talk about Jesus being the full revelation of what it means to be human, we don't mean just a repetition of the humanity that was there in Adam and Eve. We mean a continuation of the trajectory that Adam and Eve themselves were established on, and a pointing toward the eschatological humanity that we are being called to in our own right. So even with Jesus, and it puts him on the slide, but even with Jesus, I want to say, when I say he's the full revelation, I don't mean the complete, static, final, perfected revelation, even in that. Right? If he became creaturely, no single creature could possibly be the full, complete, static, no growing knowledge of God and each other and whatnot. But he is the one who best represents what that looks like, and best points us back to the track that we were supposed to be on.
That's a great place to end. Thanks so much. Well, you're very welcome to get into questions of any, but the conversation can continue up around the table up by the panel. If you want to go there, you just take your name tag on and you can leave it there on the table when you leave. If you're going to leave from here, you just leave the name tag up front and we'll get marked. Connect it here and get them out of there. Yeah.
Remember that there are some copies of the journal here if you're interested.